just coming up to 10:20. I'm Michael Walsh, the moderator for this session. So it's my pleasure to introduce Andrew Garrett and Lena Mickelson, UC Berkeley, documenting, analysing and teaching the grammar of direction in Karoo.
Thank you.
Does this work?
He hasn't spoken yet.
Thanks. I will do the whole spiel. We want to start by thanking the Karuk community members that we have worked with, elders and language teachers and activists, our colleagues, the NSF for support, and to mention that these slides are online at the location that you can no longer see. We will give some general background first about the Karuk language and about our approach to the database and web interface. Then we'll talk at some length about directionals in their grammatical context and describe a few challenges and approaches in teaching or explaining directionals, and we'll have a brief conclusion at the end. The Karuk language, also spelled with the letter O, is spoken in northwestern California along the Klamath River. It means upriver in the Karuk language. Therefore, it's not appropriate for itself because it is not upriver to itself. This is relevant for our talk. It's an isolate within the ostensible Hokan group that doesn't really exist. The vitality figures are shown here. At the time of white contact, there were about 2,000 speakers. At the time of the most thorough documentation, there were about 100 in the mid-20th century. At the present time, there are fewer than 10 first language speakers, 20 to 50 learners, and a small number of L2 users, a few of whom are extremely good, maybe two or three who are pretty fluent, I would say, maybe quite fluent. Most of the teachers are actually learners. Some of them are beginning learners, some of them are intermediate learners, and the teaching takes place in a couple of elementary and high schools and in some community classes, in no case with many, many hours per week. And of course, all of the learners are English speakers, so this is a relevant background. As of the beginning of this year, our databases consists of 150 texts with over 20,000 words in over 6,000 clauses. The texts have been collected over the last over a century by various linguists and anthropologists, including ourselves and other people in the room. The texts are of a variety of genres of the typical sort. It's weak on dialogic genres and heavy on the traditional linguistic material, narratives and elicitation sessions. This is Vina Smith, who is one of the elders that we work with, the one who we work with the most. The lexicon database originated as an appendix to Bright's Grammar of the Language, was converted to Shoebox, then was published separately, was converted to XML, and is now a MySQL database. It contains over 7,000 entries, each of which has a unique ID number. This is linked to the text corpus in that each word in the text corpus is morphologically parsed, and each morphological element is then tagged with the appropriate ID number, and you'll see the effect of doing that. All of our resources, and this is a kind of philosophical decision that we've made, are intended to be used and are in fact used both by academic researchers, learners, and teachers, and by community members who are researching, learning, and teaching. So we want tools that are rich enough that people who have esoteric interests can answer some of their questions, but also accessible enough that people who are not interested in that esoteric material can use the stuff. Florine Super is one of the language teachers. She's here talking about questions. So this is a brief guide to the way that you use or interface with the database. This is the homepage of our project. You can search the dictionaries or text database either by Karuk or English word or phrase or whatever, or by meaning or grammatical category, and you can search in the dictionary and in this sentence corpus, the text corpus. If you look for run, you'll get something like this. You search for English run, you get 92 results. This displays the first some number of them. Each of these is a clickable link, and they're arranged alphabetically. It says here index order alphabetical. If instead you're interested in what's frequent, you can toggle to what's frequent by clicking on text frequency, and you get a display of exactly the same content sorted by frequency in the text. So the first one is the most general verb for run, and then there are others within each frequency cohort. They're arranged alphabetically. Same data, just displayed in a different fashion. If you click on one of them, like the word ikvirigma, to run to a destination, which has a morpheme that we'll talk about later, you get the same information on the left, and then the dictionary entry, and all of the examples of this word, that show up in the texts. There happen to be five for this particular word. And inside the dictionary entry, the word is morphologically parsed so that you can click, you can see what the parsing is, and you can also click on each of the pieces and it will take you to the appropriate dictionary entry for that piece, whether it's a root or a suffix. If the way the sentences are displayed is a little unclear, you can switch to a gloss display, which we call word components. And then each of the words is parsed morphologically, and each of those is a clickable link that takes you to the dictionary entry for that root or word or morphological piece. If one of them was in a text, like this number two and number three are from a text called Coyote Goes to a War Dance, you can click on Read the Full Text, and then you're on reading the full text. This is a display sentence by sentence. If that's confusing to you, you can click on Word Components, which shows a glossed display. And again, you can click on each of the ingredients and go back to the dictionary, and so on. So it's intended to be sort of visually easy to use and also to integrate as much as possible the text and dictionary corpus. And I should say, we forgot to include any audio, but here in this presentation, a lot of material has audio, and if there is audio, there's a way of clicking on that to listen to whatever it is. This is a dictionary search for a directional suffix, ramni, meaning into some contained thing. And this shows all of the, it's a little blurry, but it shows all of the derivatives, all of the morphological derivatives of this piece. So anything in the dictionary that has morphological derivatives, those are shown in a list. And what's listed here under sentence examples, there are eight of them, are all of the examples in sentences where either this morpheme shows up or any derivative of this morpheme, so any more complex thing that is formed with it. So if you're interested in this suffix, you would go to this page and you would find all the examples listed of this suffix, but you might be interested in just one of these derived verbs that contains that suffix. So you could click on one of those, like ishkak ramni, to jump into, and then you would get this page, which is for that verb itself, and that shows only the one text example of that verb. So it shows you that it's derived from jump plus this suffix into, but the only example that's displayed is the example of this derived form. And that's an important distinction between searches that will display all of the examples of a piece, that's a search on a piece, versus searches that will display all of the examples of a derived form. So why are directionals interesting to talk about? One is their frequency. 12 of the 40 highest frequency Kadok verbs contain directionals in them. Secondly, they've been of interest to typologists. So Evans and Levinson comment in their notorious paper that there have been predictions that there would not be prepositions or spatial relators, quote, encoding featural properties of objects, but Kadok has precisely such a spatial verbal suffix, meaning in through a tubular space. And thirdly, in the riverine ecology where the language has traditionally been spoken and was spoken at the time of contact, the directional system is highly salient, and this comes out in text after text and traditional discourse. So this is just an example from a text where she is explaining, because of that, the water flows downstream from here with a directional, and also because of that, the salmon run upstream. And so sentences with these directionals on the upriver-downriver axis and the uphill-downhill axis are extremely common in traditional sources because it looks like this. With the canyons are very steep, and so wherever you are in the river basin, upriver-downriver and uphill-downhill are highly salient. Kadok has pretty agglutinating verbal morphology. Here are some words, sentences. This one has a verb root, drink, preceded by an inflectional prefix, preceded by a negative clitic, and the root is followed by a future suffix and a negative suffix. In number two, the verb root, be quiet, is preceded by an inflectional prefix and followed by a directional suffix, down, with an aspectual force, and then a causative, and then a future. And in number three, the verb root, to carry in a burden basket, is preceded by an iterative prefix, preceded by an inflectional suffix, preceded by a tense aspect prefix, and the root is followed by one of these directional suffixes into an enclosed space. The structure of the verb, according to Bright's grammar, is a root will be preceded by some number of prefixes, agreement, iterative, manner, root duplication, and there are something like 60 suffixes, maybe in 12 position classes, five of which are derivational and seven of which are inflectional. inflectional position classes express tense aspect and some other categories that are listed here, and the derivational ones in five classes are the event external pluractional, some less productive ones. In class three, the directionals that we'll be focusing on, and then in class four and five, some ones that are mainly valence changing and similar. So these directionals are mainly in class three, and the class three suffixes are listed here. There are some unpaired ones, meaning that these are directional suffixes that do not coexist with ones that mean their inverse. And then mostly they're paired suffixes. This is just a picture of the chart from Bright's grammar, which, thank you, I will expand here. Some of them express deixis, so there's one that means towards there, and there's one that means towards here. Then towards here is expanded in a variety of other ones, so towards here from uphill, towards here from upriver, towards here from across a body of water. All the ones on the right are hither, that is towards here. And all the ones on the left under moo are from here, hence downriverward, hence downhillward, hence uphillward, and they're opposed to the ones that express hither. So these are paired ones that involve deixis. They're also a set of paired directional suffixes that involve specification of the ground, for example, one's mouth, into one's mouth or out of one's mouth, or the tubular space, into a tubular space, out through a tubular space, and there are a few miscellaneous ones that we won't mention. So there are a number of parameters in the directional system, and typically they have these opposed pairs. They have been analyzed by Macaulay in a paper in 2004 into, this is a picture from her chart, into some groups. There are class one directionals that do not add an argument. An example of that is Ishri, meaning down. There are then class two ones that add an argument that she calls applicatives. Class 2A is simple applicatives that simply indicate the path of some object that's already, like suru, meaning off, and then 2B, applicatives plus an object which a good example is this ramni, meaning into a container, where it specifies already the ground, the container. And then in class 2C, these are ones like mu, meaning to there, and faku, meaning to here from uphill. They're ones that convey a goal and deixis. So mu is a distal, expresses a distal goal, and faku expresses a proximal goal. And the difference between mu and a difference between mu and faku in her analysis is that faku expresses in addition the path from uphill. So in some sense, semantically, faku is more complicated than mu, because mu simply expresses the deixis, distal, and the fact of the goal, whereas faku expresses both the deixis and the goal and the path. And one thing that has been interesting to us is the way that this sense of complexity intersects with complexity in language learning, and that leads us to describe a couple of challenges. The first challenge is the difference between complexity in, for example, Macaulay's sense and complexity of learning, where our sense is that some things that are more complex syntactically or semantically might actually be easier to learn, because simplicity may correspond to generality of usage. And for example, syntactic simplicity might involve fewer features or fewer required arguments, or semantic simplicity might imply a more general meaning or less topological specificity. And covering more ground, therefore, so to speak, this might involve difficulty in learning and teaching the relevant category. There is, in other words, a trade-off, we think, between analytic complexity, which does not necessarily correspond to pedagogical complexity. There's some kind of inverse between those things. In other words, the most semantically specific categories might actually be the easiest to learn, because they are, as we'll say in a minute, semantically coherent. A second challenge is the non-equivalence of translations. So the most general directionals sort of correspond to some English prepositions, but there's the correspondence is quite imperfect. There's this general purpose mu suffix that means towards there, and in some instances you can easily translate it as to, ikfuk mu crawl to, but an English-speaking learner who encounters this might be inclined to think of it as to always, and that's not going to work very well. And the mismatches are bidirectional, like we say, so there are some words where mu is present, but the English translation would not normally involve to. So fall plus this means reach. If you are coming from an English starting point, which the learners are, then you might not think that reach should include this, but it does, and there are quite a number of examples of that sort. And there are also examples the other way, that is, contexts where to is appropriate in English, but But this mu, which expresses spatial direction, is not appropriate in Kaduk, so there's a suffix unish for verbs of speech, for example, the goal of verbs of speech. Mu is never used for that in that context. There's a benefactive suffix I that usually would be translated for, but sometimes with verbs of transfer, it's translated as to, and that's also not, mu is not appropriate in that context. So the way that the space of to and corresponding spaces in Kaduk are carved up is different. So we think it's actually not that useful to think in these very general terms about the relationship between the Kaduk category and the English category. And a third problem is sociocultural changes, as a result of which a lot of people live outside the area where the riverine landscape is salient. Even there, modern systems of communication and transportation are not as river-oriented as they were, and also some of today's elders don't use some of the less common directionals. We decided to refer to our approach as a smuggler's guide, both alluding to Lenore's plenary and also to a dictum that we have adapted from Leanne Hinton, that you should smuggle grammar into life rather than explaining grammar explicitly. So one way of characterizing what we're trying to do is to think of breaking down grammatical patterns into pragmatic contexts that are determined by semantically coherent neighborhoods, local coherence maxima, if you like that algebraic term. I think this is similar to what to some things that we learned about yesterday in the plenary by Grenoble, talking about situational contexts for language learning, and then the talk by Chris Cox talking about paradigmatic learning, even of complex morphology. And we think that you can think of situational paradigms, and that's kind of what we're trying to construct. So one example is an example of an extremely semantically specific pair, furuk and rupuk, into a house and or out of a house or any enclosure generally, where you can take an individual verb and you can add the one suffix or the other suffix, and they predictably mean the appropriate inverse things. And so we think of having exercises in the classroom where you act out, jumping in or going in or whatever it is, the relevant thing, and with a number of different verbs. And because the meanings are quite predictable, people can learn this pretty easily, and because the contexts are pragmatically salient, it makes sense to people, I think. So here are some examples from, they're all examples from texts. They ran indoors, so with the destination actually expressed, indoors with a separate adverbial, but you don't have to do that. She jumped in her den or lair with ari, and then here's ari with the other suffix, ari rupuk, she jumped out, the old woman jumped out. And there are plenty of pairs of this sort that one could use in the classroom setting that are common and I think make sense culturally. A second example is with the directional suffix down, ishri, which can be contrast, you can contrast situations paradigmatically where it is used versus situations where it isn't used. So if you talk about motion without using, with a verb like fall, without using this suffix, then you will be profiling the actual period of the falling. So this means he fell for a long time, or it was a long time that he fell. If you add ish, you will be profiling the endpoint of the fall, of the falling, so, the destination, and oftentimes there'll be an actual goal expressed. So he fell down to the ground, or just I fell down with a kind of resultative tenth aspect marker. And again, these situationally contrasting paradigms are easy to learn with the same verbs, and you could demonstrate them or show little pictures or whatever is appropriate, and I think they're, thank you, they're intuitive. And we envision doing similar things with other, with the inverse suffix, the one that means up, which is also very common, with transitive frames, but separately for these same morphemes, so lift up, put down, carry up, you know, whatever, with very pragmatically specific frames, and then contrasting what it means in the situational context to use the thing versus what it means in the situational context to not use it, as opposed to talking in general terms about ishri means down and sipri means up initially. And then finally, one could talk about aspectual uses of these same things. Third example is with this mu morpheme that means towards. There are really two subtypes here. There are some very common verbs that contain mu but do not alternate with parallel verbs without it. These are extremely common verbs, arrive, waram, to leave, ipma. to return or go back. And these will select for a goal. When they show up in sentences, they will typically have a goal argument, and people are used to hearing these words. So you just sort of would teach these without teaching. There is no paradigmatically opposed zero verb. These verbs themselves are paradigmatically opposed in the sense of leave versus arrive, and that would probably be the opposition that you would teach. There's also a bunch of verbs where you can use the mu suffix, which surfaces sometimes as ma, or not use it. Here we refer to these as location versus goal contexts, and these are the same verbs, paddle and float. If you use the verb paddle without the suffix and you have a locational expression in the sentence, it means that's where you're doing it. The man is paddling in the water, or the boat is floating out in the water. If you use, you could have used this same word in these sentences. If you use it with ma, it means you're going there. So they paddled towards Yves. They floated towards around there. If you didn't have ma here, it would mean they floated around there. If you used uth down here, it would mean they floated towards out in the water. And so you would have paired sentences that differ only in whether they have ma or not, and that vary the individual manner of motion verb. And I think, again, situationally, it's very easy for people to understand the difference between these contexts because they're very familiar and they're minimally different. But you're not talking in high-level terms about mu means to. You're talking about the difference between actual practical scenarios. And those are a few kinds of examples that have seemed interesting and in the cases where we've been able to do it, effective to us. In general, we think for probably any complex grammatical categories, a useful goal could be to identify these local coherence maxima, pragmatic or situational contexts where some semantically coherent patterns can be found and contrasted with paradigmatically opposed contexts. And I think this is how language learning has traditionally been done in cases, at least. So when you learn the German accusative versus dative with verbs of motion, you don't learn everything about the accusative and everything about the dative at that time. You contrast that particular pair of patterns. Or when you learn Greek and Latin cases, you don't learn every single thing about the dative at one time. You learn the dative of disadvantage, and then there's a long dossier of semantically distinct subtypes that you learn by case. They're semantically coherent maxima. We think also it's helpful to know what's frequent and what's infrequent in usage. I would say that's kind of obvious. But we also think it's helpful to know what the derivatives of a given form are, what all of the examples of all of the derivatives are, or all of the examples of one derivative, and the data structure that we've developed in the web interface have been helpful tools in being able to investigate, in being able to know these things or try to know these things.
Okay, we have about 8 minutes for questions or comments. Anyone? Yes?
I just want to say you had a couple of groups sitting here.
Oh.
Ayuki.
We couldn't hear.
Oh, I just said there's a couple of group members.
There's also Kurok data on the internet intercontinental dictionary series IDS. Do you know where that came from and how does it compare to your dictionary?
It's not as good. I'm not sure what the exact. I mean, I think it comes from Bright's. I think originally it was extracted from Bright's dictionary appendix and then went through some complicated pathway to that location. It's not that big, and I mean it's presumably accurate because Bright was a very good linguist. But in any cases where there's revision of our understanding of the entry, it will be inaccurate.
Do you know who did it? And would you say it's okay to use accurate?
It's okay. I never personally used it because.
Okay.
I don't feel that we need to, but I'd be happy to look at it and send you an email or something.
Sure.
Karen.
I just tell you about a kind of variation on this that we've done with teachers to kind of understand verb structure. So after going through a lot of these, then we've made up verb stems. like hop on one foot or something like that, and then did like charades of trying to guess what it was.
Oh, charade, really, that's great, yeah.
Yeah, people really enjoyed it. You know, so just make up some weird verbs down that wouldn't be in the language, and then you can do on top of it and out, and all of these kind of contrasting ones.
I mean, I've done, charades is a great idea. I've done like telling somebody to do, you know, hop around or crawl. People love crawling because it's so demeaning. but the charades is a great idea.
Yeah. So people really enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah. And I should have mentioned, I didn't mention that what we've been doing, like we have not ourselves been directly teaching the students in the classes, but our interactions, I mean, we've been in those classes, but our kind of pedagogical interactions have been with the teachers, who are also learners.
What did you think was the advantage of using the made-up verb stem?
Well, we were trying to show the productivity of the patterns, and that having learned some pieces, they could create more things. And so to say, well, what if we made up something totally new, and then look how much you can do with it already.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yes.
Were there any directions that were specific to the Tarot area, or were they exportable generally, or are there some that you used in Berkeley and some that not used in Berkeley?
Are there any that are, the question was, are there any that are specific to the Karuk area? I don't know. I would say there are none that are specific to Karuk as opposed to the Hupa area or the Yurok area, which are the immediately nearby areas, or generally any of the Pacific Coast riverine ecosystems. This would be, many of these terms would be quite inappropriate in the Great Basin, I think, where the salience of the riverine, there's not much salience to a riverine ecology. Berkeley, I think it would work reasonably well. I mean, anywhere where there's a landscape that has creeks and rivers, it should work. It is an interesting question how, when you don't actually navigate on those, and how you transfer these terms to other modes of transport, and I don't know if you have opinions about this, but what I have heard from people is that some people will use these directionals not for rivers but for roads. I have not actually heard anybody do it, but I have heard people say that they do it.
Well, we're from Hoopa, and then we have Yurok here. And even our English, when we speak, we do a lot of directional, like, I'm heading to my brother's, you know, I'm heading up to my brother's.
Oh, yeah, sure.
It's
yeah.
Up
yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Or I'm heading down to the store, you know, because that's downriver. We all speak it in our English. So.
Yeah, but the question is then, what happens if there's no actual, like in a situation where the highway is doing something that a river might do, but there isn't actually a waterway nearby, then do you say, you know, if there's a road that's going from Hoopa, the road that
our
goes
road follows pretty much along the river. There's
well, but like the road that
yeah.
goes the road that goes from Hoopa, the road that goes over Bald Hills, like there's
Bald
not
Hill,
a creek
yeah.
there's not a creek along that road, and you say that the part of the road that's going up to the top of the hill from Hoopa,
well,
are you going up?
River. I mean, from Hoopa, you're still heading downriver to head to Bald Hill,
right.
So it's
still
yeah, it's, yeah, you're heading down. It's all directional.
It's really too bad that at the time when there were large communities of speakers really kind of actively using the language, that people didn't think of robustly documenting the usage of this terminology.
So coming a little bit closer to home here, these riverine directional terms can be transferred to broader context. Here in Hawaii, it's Mauka Makai toward the interior, toward the sea.
Yeah.
But that probably started in a riverine context in Taiwan, where toward the interior and upriver mean the same thing, downriver and toward the sea. That wouldn't work in the Karo case because their territory didn't reach the sea. I mean, the Yurok were the ones who were in the lower part of the Klamath River. But in any case, you can see how it transfers. Here in Hawaii, it's really not upriver, downriver at all.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe in Berkeley where the creeks exist but are not salient, maybe that would be the way of talking about how that transfer would take place.
We've got time for maybe one more question. Yep.
I think you mentioned at one point that some of those directional suffixes are valency increasing, is that right? So in the examples that you showed, though, did you have examples where you can see that you have an additional
we did.
You only had enough, only with sort of an adverbial noun.
Exactly.
Yes.
So all of those seemed to me like they were adverbs, whereas the nouns had that ba article or whatever that is. So can you have that sort of structure to be the object of,
right.
of that
yes.
verb?
Yes. So jump into a boat.
Yeah.
Okay.
There.
Okay.
Yeah. You would have the boat there with a locative marker on the boat. Actually.
Okay.
Yeah. We were just trying. I guess we were trying to get simple sentences, but there are lots of examples of that
yeah.
of that sort.
Okay, it's about time anyway, so thanks again.